questions about drug development costs, the value and pricing of medicines, and different ways to go about answering these questions are hot and are increasingly heard in healthcare policy and legislative discussions all around the world. Who determines how much society and/or patients should pay for medicine, and how are those determinations made? I am Alberto Grignolo, Deputy Editor for DIA's Global Forum. Today, I am joined by Professor Sarah Garner, Associate Director, Science Policy and Research for the UK's National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, the familiar acronym NICE, and a pharmacist with special expertise in the interface between health technology assessment and regulation. Professor Garner will participate in a panel discussion on value-based healthcare decision-making, the quest for smarter spending, at our DIA 2016 annual meeting in Philadelphia. And we are pleased to have this opportunity to discuss this critical topic with her today. Thank you for your time today, Professor Garner, and welcome.
Thank you very much.
First question, if I may, I would really value your historical perspective. Have HTA bodies led the global move towards value-based assessments, or have they followed it?
So if we start with HTA, HTA, I think it's got lost in the midst of time, but it actually started in the United States about 20 years ago. It gained popularity, then moved to Australia, where we have the Australian PBAC system, the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee. But it was only really when NICE picked it up 15 years ago and started implementing health economics at the national level that it started gaining prominence. So it was being done in pockets globally for quite a while. And NICE's assessment uses the cost-utility analysis, which is the cost-utility is the way of assessing value, which looks at the number of health outcome units that are generated and how much it costs to get more health outcome units. So that's how NICE has taken that forward, and that has been the core of our methodology for, say, the last 15, 16 years. However, there's been other movements globally, and the one that always interests me as well is you can see a very interesting mirror in the discussions that's been going on in the American healthcare system with payment for outcomes. It's moved very much from and in recent years as well, from payment for procedures done to payment from outcomes. So there's mirrors in other aspects of healthcare rather than just pharmaceuticals. So I wouldn't know how to unpick that. It's complicated. But interestingly, going forward, when we first started, the premise was that these drugs were expensive, but if those drugs were provided, they provided a lot of value and would save healthcare costs in the long run, which is all the, you know, the heart of this cost utility analysis. But as we move forward, we are now getting into the grounds where the drugs are becoming more and more expensive. So we're starting to see more of a tension between affordability and value. And I don't know going forward how we're going to address that.
Very interesting indeed. So these movements towards value-based assessments and the evolution of HTAs have progressed more or less in parallel, would you say?
Yes.
Second question, what has NICE contributed to the EMA's Adaptive Pathways Pilot and related Medicines Adaptive Pathways to Patients, or MAPS, initiatives? And what are its plans for future collaborations with EMA and other regulatory agencies in this area?
So that one's an easy one for me to answer personally. So the MAPS, or Medicines Adaptive Pathways, that started off as an initiative that was led out of the United States, based at MIT NUDIG collaboration. So I was very fortunate enough to be sponsored by the Commonwealth Fund on a Harkness Fellowship. And as part of that Harkness Fellowship, I worked with the MIT NUDIG group to develop the adaptive licensing proposal. And so I was coming up and very much representing the HTA stroke payer viewpoint. So a lot of the publication's initial focus focused on the regulatory aspects, but I've certainly been thinking about this for a very long time from the HTA perspective. And we then move forward, and we've now got a pilot that's ongoing at the EMA, and we've also got the Adapt Smart or MAPS program, which is a coordination support action, which has been funded by the Innovative Medicines Initiative, which is the world's largest public-private partnership. So there's a lot of activity. So I've personally been involved with MIT NUDIG for a while. NICE has been collaborating corporately with some of the initiatives that NUDIG has been running, particularly something called the JANUS initiative. And then we've been contributing quite heavily to the pilot, the EMA pilot. So myself and a couple of other colleagues actively participate in the Safe Harbour call, and I've been liaising with the EMA to set up the infrastructure around that pilot from the HTA perspective. And we've now moved into a very interesting phase. So NICE has opened something called the Office for Market Access. We've piloted offering companies UK Safe Harbour, in which they can discuss the route through the UK system. So with the route through the payer, the route through the HTA, and the research components that would be needed, along with pricing agreements. So we're reflecting what's been done on the regulatory level in the system level. And would you like me to tell you a little bit more about AdaptSmart? Would that be helpful as well?
Yes, please do. Yes, thank you.
So AdaptSmart, it's a 2.5-year project which has been funded by the Innovative Medicines Initiative. And this is, as I said, the world's largest public-private consortium, the FPA, which is the European Federation of Pharmaceutical Industry and Associates, works with the European Commission, the IMI office, to put forward projects. The FPA companies that contribute, so these are sort of a lot of the usual suspects, they contribute in kind. A number of the companies will play a leading role in each project, so they contribute existing staff. And then the money that is matched by the European Commission and goes towards paying for public policy partners and academics and other organisations in relation to the public sector. And they jointly look at some of the major issues that are facing drug development today and propose solutions. And that's what we've been doing with MAPS. We've been looking at all the aspects and implications for MAPS for a system, because it's a system-wide change, and looking at seeing what we do know about it and where the issues are that need more work.
Thank you. Let me ask you a related question, and that is in relation to adaptive pathways and, if you will, rapid approval pathways. Is there a possibility that the body of clinical data generated by sponsors to achieve approval under these pathways might be insufficient for HTAs to perform their assessments of the value of new medicine if the amount of clinical data is less than they would like to see?
So this situation is what's happening at the moment. It's been happening for a very long time. Certainly, I've been working at NICE for 15 years, and we've always had an issue that the evidence that we get has usually been created for regulatory purposes. So HTA is very much an afterthought, and primarily aimed at the US market. And as a result, we rarely have head-to-head trials of the new intervention versus best practice in the UK. So we're very used to that situation of not having sufficient data, and that's why we've gone down the route that's a little different from the regulators, where we have a lot of modelling and decision modelling, and it, in order to make maximal use of the information that we have, because we don't have those direct head-to-head trials. So we put in a range of initiatives, so NICE, other HTA agencies, and now we do have arrangements jointly with the regulators where we do scientific advice, where we actually advise companies on their development strategy, on individual studies they're planning, and try to make sure that the HTA necessary components are incorporated into them. What we've found is, again, that we've still got those regulatory concerns, and perhaps it's often the US market or Japanese market, that we're still not, for a variety of reasons, we're not getting the necessary evidence, or those discussions are happening too late, which is why in the adaptive licensing work, the adaptive MAPS work, that we're having the safe harbour calls with the companies very, very early on in development, so we can ensure we can build those needs into the development pathway, rather than us being consulted when the phase 3-2 plans or trials have been made and the trials will be started when it's too late to do the HTA piece. So I very much see this as a positive. It's a chance for the companies and the regulators, the payers, the HTA, and to some extent the patients and clinicians to interact and actually influence those development plans for everybody's benefit. And then the other thing to remember as well with these drugs, that the MAP pilot is very much about drugs for unmet need. So these are very, very experimental treatments. There's often no existing treatment. So it is very small patient numbers. So these are these are very, very hard conditions in which to do RCTs in.
Quite. In fact, I presume, you can confirm or not confirm this as you wish, but I presume that one would not want to be in a situation where a drug is developed and approved by regulators rapidly for an unmet medical need, and the HTAs push back and they say, well, sorry, but we don't see enough data here to
exactly
make an assessment and to recommend reimbursement. That would be perhaps an unfortunate situation, would it not be?
That would be unfortunate for everybody, yes. We want to ensure it's fair enough if that drug is not delivering, if it's proved to not deliver, or it's just too expensive for the benefits that it's bringing. That's one scenario, but the worst case scenario is where we just don't have that evidence on which to base a decision because there's too much uncertainty.
I believe what you're saying is that a approach of prevention where regulators, payers, and sponsors get together early in drug development, as you mentioned, can plan out the entire process of development so that it will include data to satisfy regulators as well as HTAs.
Yes, exactly. Yes, that's my point exactly. And it also it gives us an opportunity because the system, so this is the drug development system, has been focused on RCTs for a very long time. We're very good at the methodology of RCTs. We've had 60, 70 years to think about it, whereas we're only just now starting to explore real-world data and the contribution. So we're very much behind methodologically as a society on these studies. We need to improve the methods, and we need to be very careful about the strategies we use and discuss them, because there are inherent weaknesses, obviously, in this data.
Let me move to another question, certainly related to this topic, and that is, in your view, does knowledge of the true cost of developing a medicine have a role to play in the process of determining the value and particularly the pricing of that medicine?
I would like to say yes, but that's coming from my perspective. In reality, I'm not sure that's the case, and it's been very interesting as me as a sort of an observer in all of this, watching how the dynamics, how the rhetoric's changed over the last 5 years, because previously the case was put forward very strongly that the reason the medicines are so expensive is because of the development cost, and I'm not seeing that argument been used as much recently.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. Yeah, that'll be it's I wouldn't like to guess, but again, I think we've historically had pricing based on the amount the market will bear, and that of course is not related to the development cost. So they're very, very different strategies, and because the pricing, the calculations that are used to developing pricing, the pricing strategies for different countries, that's not transparent. So nobody really has a clear idea of what's happening. So it leads to a lack of trust.
There are those who call for greater transparency around drug development costs. Do you think there should be such greater transparency, or do you respect the right of companies, if you will, to maintain that information confidential?
I think if companies are asking the prices they're asking, which is problematic for the healthcare system for very real reasons, for that opportunity cost, all those budgets, are under pressure, and whether it's a publicly funded healthcare system or a privately funded healthcare system, I think if they're wanting to attract those premium prices, there has to be more justification of it.
Understood. Final question, Professor Garner. The large and comprehensive body of work that NICE has produced over time has generated, as we all know, a full spectrum of emotions in recent years. Let me ask you, this may be a bit controversial, but is NICE an angel or is NICE the devil?
Oh, that's a great question. I like that one.
Forgive me.
So, yeah, this is a really interesting question, and I think you're gonna, if you ask that to other people, you're gonna get a range of answers, and it all depends from where in the spectrum of drug development and access where you sit on that spectrum. What I will say, and this is part of it, I mentioned I was lucky enough to spend the year in the United States on a Harkness Fellowship. I was working a lot with Peter Newman and Sean Tunis, who are great mentors. And my research question was, what impact will comparative effectiveness research, which is the US name for some of the components of HTA, what impact will that have on innovation? And I got to speak and interview, I got privileged access to quite a lot of players in a system that I wouldn't do normally as an HTA person. So, you know, that's all the way through from venture capitalists right at the start to scientists, to patients, to clinicians, to people in the sector, so commentators like Brookings Institute, so journalists I spoke to as well. And it very, very, very much became very quickly apparent that actually HTA is blamed for a lot of things, but all we do is shine a torch on what's happened earlier in the development pathway and decisions that have been made much earlier on. Because we make a decision, NICE and other organisations, this is all in the public domain. So we shine a torch on those decisions. They often hit the spotlight. They're controversial because they're usually sort of tied up with ethical issues and access issues and public spending issues. So I think we get a lot of attention for a lot of decisions that aren't necessarily anything to do with HTA. And again, this is a lot of the work we've been doing in new digs, in the MAPS activities and a number of other activities, is trying to get the system to work better together to find some solutions to this.
Are you saying that those who blame HTAs for basically denying access of new medicines to patients are barking up the wrong tree, if I may say so?
Yes. I wouldn't say barking up the tree. There's a lot of trees in this wood, a lot of different decisions along the pathway, and it's actually not all the responsibility of HTA. You know, pricing discussions, the HTA decisions, there's sort of three or four components, if you like. There's issues around pricing, there's issues around effectiveness and comparative effectiveness, so what are we actually getting for that? There's issues around healthcare budget, and there's issues around, you know, sort of bigger strategic macroeconomic benefits which countries all see from pharmaceutical development. So it's quite a complicated picture, and different countries vary in the how they address these things. But yes, it's not all the responsibility of HTA agencies.
Your sessions at the IA will deal with value-based healthcare decision making, the quest for smarter spending. If you think ahead, say a 10-year horizon, maybe even 20-year horizon, what is the ideal state of play, your opinion? There are many moving parts, of course. This is a very complex debate, as you noted, and many others have noted.
Yeah.
What is the ideal state that the world should achieve?
I wish I had a crystal ball at this stage. I'm not sure where we're going to end. If I'm honest about this, I'm not sure where we're going to end up with these discussions. There's a lot of moving parts. There's a massive debate, which you'll obviously be very well aware about, going on in the United States about the cost. That's something I don't think, if the position in the United States change about pharmaceutical costs, then I think we're going to be able to see a change in other countries. And until that happens, I think we're going to be having continued discussions along the same vein as we've been having for the last decade. So that's a moving part. There's another moving part around the contributions of the healthcare systems to drug development. So there's a lot of investment in the UK and other countries going into real-world data infrastructure. So if we can finesse the methodology, we can understand, we've got data science as an emerging field. If we can finesse the methodology, we might be able to bring development costs down even more, because we can use the infrastructure in the healthcare system to collect data. And some of that additional costs around running trials, that's going to come down. So that's another moving part. The other difficulty we've got at the moment is there's a vision, I hear the word about personalised reimbursement strategies, and also differential pricing by indication. At the moment, the healthcare systems are not going to be able to deliver that. That's an enormous administrative burden. Most European healthcare systems don't have the insurance infrastructure in place, so we don't have a claims basis. So we've got to think about how that might be delivered without adding an administrative burden onto a healthcare system that's in crisis at the moment. So yeah, there's a lot of moving parts. I could probably give that a whole talk in itself, I think. Yeah, I'm not sure where we're going to end up with that discussion. The important thing, I think, is that discussion is happening and it continues to happen.
As you describe it, it's an enormously complex ecosystem, yet patients are waiting for medicines, and this is the ultimate standard, isn't it? So this has to be solved in some way. In this ecosystem, it seems that everybody will have to give in a little rather than one party or two having to give in the most. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yes. Yeah, there's got to be changes at all levels, and it's the discussions around the balance of those changes. And to do that, we need a better understanding than we've got of the impact of any changes.
We will watch this space with interest in the coming years and perhaps decades. Thank you very much, Professor Garner, for your contributions to patient care in the UK. And thank you for discussing these important topics with us today. Thank you.
You are very welcome, and I'm extremely looking forward to the DIA session. Thank you.